Welcome to Stutter Talk, everybody. We are excited to be here tonight. We're recording from Albany, New York. Eric Jackson here with Peter Reitzis.
Hey, everyone.
Our good friend, regular guest, and our gracious host, Mr. Joe Klein.
Hi, everybody.
And
Dr. Joe.
Dr. Joe Klein. How could I? I'm sorry, Joe. And his beautiful daughter, Greta. Say hi, Greta.
Hi.
It's so nice to have you with us tonight.
Everything's better with Greta.
Everything's better with Greta. And first-time guest, our buddy Steve Marchant. Hey, Steve, what's up?
What's going on, everyone?
Not too much. We're happy to be up here in Albany right now. We took a little bit of a road trip yesterday, and it's always nice to come up here and hang with the Kleins and company.
Snow's on the ground, the air is crisp.
And the drinks, I probably don't have to say, are flowing. Stutter Talk at stuttertalk.com, 206-888-4619. So, we're going to record a bunch of stuff, and I say that we just get right into it. So where shall we begin?
Well, I'd like to make a couple announcements because there's lots of good stuff going on in the stuttering world. Camp Art Time has announced its 2010 camp session, August 8th through the 15th. Camp Art Time is a sleepaway arts camp for young people who stutter and their siblings, families and friends, ages 8 through 18, outside of New York City. For more information, go to ourtimetheater.org. We also want to congratulate Stutter Talk friend and past guest, Lays Geddes, for taking on his battle of false stuttering cure claims with Google, and it looks like he's had a... Well, it looks like Lays and the British Stammering Association has had quite a victory over in the United Kingdom. So basically, I don't want to say the name of the company because they're still available in the United States, but the British government, their Advertising Standards Authority, looks to have come out and said basically that this one specific company has no evidence to support their claim of a stuttering cure. Yeah. So we're going to link to the article from the British newspaper on stuttertalk.com, episode 166, right, Eric?
Yeah. Yes. And these stuttering cure sites or links or whatever are those things that unfortunately come up on the right-hand side of the page when you do a keyword search on stuttering in a search engine like Google. So the first thing a lot of people see is cure your stuttering in 7 days or stop stuttering now with this. So this really is a cool thing, and I'm psyched for Lays, and I hope that he keeps plugging away at this stuff.
Absolutely. We want to mention one more thing. When you're doing your holiday shopping, remember Stutter Talk. And remember that you can support Stutter Talk by going to stuttertalk.com, finding our Amazon search engine in the left-hand sidebar, and doing your holiday shopping through that Amazon search engine. And when you do that, Stutter Talk gets a piece of the money that you spend. The price is the same. There's no additional fees, but we get anywhere from 1 to 2 to I think even up to 5 or 6% of your purchase. So keep us in mind, stuttertalk.com, Amazon search engine in the left-hand side bar.
Show me the money.
Show me the money. Joe.
Just kidding.
Joe Klein, you mentioned last night when we were having a few friendly drinks, you asked the question, where are all the stutterers? Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, if there are 10 million people about in New York City, right, there should be about 100,000 people who stutter in New York City. And I guess what I was wondering is where is everybody?
I have wondered this myself for some time, and I don't have exact numbers, but in the self-help world, I'm going to estimate in the United States, there's about 4,000 to 5,000 people who belong to the NSA, Friends, Art Time, and the other support groups. So if there are 3 million Americans in the United States who stutter, where are they all? So I'm going to come out here and put my views on the table. In a classic book on stuttering, Woody Starkweather wrote that there are definitely people who are completely covert, but there's only a handful. There's not a lot. I think Dr. Starkweather was wrong. Mm-hmm. I think that completely covert stutterers make up the majority of people who stutter. And I think that people who stutter overtly, who are heard and seen as stutterers, are the minority in the stuttering world.
I think, though, that there are many people who stutter, and I'm going to talk a little bit about me and my brothers. My brothers stutter, but they are not involved in the stuttering community. Stuttering doesn't seem to get in their way. So I think there's a lot of people who might stutter overtly, but just don't feel that they need to be involved in this self-help community.
I think the real question here is not where are all the stutterers. I think what the question is why aren't there more people involved in self-help and in therapy? Right. I also have a brother who stutters, you know, but it's just not really an issue for him. So he lives his life. He has found ways to cope, and who knows if the ways that he has found up to this point will keep going throughout the rest of his life. But for 22 years, it has.
Yeah, and I think, too, that, you know, perhaps there are lots of people out there who do stutter, but that have a, you know, pretty high threshold for what makes them stutter. You know, we actually had a conversation this morning with a guy who said that, you know, he was here hanging out at the house for a different reason, and he said that, when Eric was doing a really good job being open about his own stuttering, he said, well, yeah, you know, I stutter too, you know, when I get really nervous or anxious. And so something that Eric said was that, well, you know, no, you don't really stutter. You just get disfluent. But almost having this conversation.
I wasn't being too much of a jerk, was I?
No, not at all. And it's something that I was thinking about too. It maybe we're wrong. Maybe he does stutter. And that, you know, it only takes a really, you know, a really nervous situation to bring out the stuttering for him, and that for the rest of the day he can get by, you know, and he can pass as a fluent person, and he may even view himself as a fluent person for most of the day. I don't know.
I think that's a fair point to wonder about. I do want to say, though, growing up, I never met another person who stuttered until I was graduating from college. I was about 21 years old. I grew up in Delaware, and I went home. I lived until I was 18 in Delaware, and I went in my 20s, like 27, 28. I was getting a sandwich in Delaware, and I heard somebody really stuttering up a storm in public. And I realized it was the first time in my home state. had ever heard anyone stutter. And that goes beyond self-help and therapy and directly to the point of where are all the stutterers? I mean, if I can go up through my 20, into my early 20s, never having heard somebody else stutter, then where are they all? That's not an uncommon experience. And I'm going to go back to it. I think most people who stutter are hiding. And that's my gut on it.
But look, though, how many people, like new people, do you actually meet on a daily basis? You know, like how many new situations are you in all the time?
Right. But swimming pools every summer, baseball team, stamp collecting clubs.
So when you were a kid, you're saying right now.
Right. High school, college, all the activities I did, Hebrew school. I was around so many people. Now, if we play the odds, I should have grown up with dozens of people who stutter, if not more.
I just want to add one cool thing, and then I know you have something to say, Steve. It wasn't until I was like 25 or 26 that I actually remembered seeing people as a kid stutter. Like, I thought when I first started getting involved in self-help and in therapy and meeting other people who stutter and becoming part of the stuttering world and all that, I thought initially that that was the first time that I ever met anybody who stuttered. And then I reflected, you know, and I think a big part of me would or may have heard, seen a lot of stuttering, but because I was ashamed of it, I kind of pushed it away or conveniently forgot about it.
You might have done that with one person, but if there were dozens of people who you heard stuttering growing up, and the odds are there should have been dozens, if not hundreds, you couldn't have possibly repressed all of those. So even if you repressed, and I don't mean repressed like some deep psychological problem, I mean even if you tamped down one or two childhood experiences hearing stutterers, that still doesn't account for the fact that there should have been many, many more stuttering voices.
I'm just wondering if there are people who stutter out there who don't consider them people who or don't consider them a person who stutters. It's coming into my mind. We had recently gone to a Civil War reenactment up in Saratoga, and one of the reenactors there was this big, tough, burly guy, and he was giving a demonstration about, you know, a gun or a cannon, and he was stumbling over his words, and to me it seemed as if he was stuttering. And I said to my wife after we had left, "Didn't that guy stutter?" And she was like, "Yeah." But it didn't seem to bother him. He just kind of went, you know, through the demonstration, and I was wondering if there are many people who don't consider tripping over their words as stuttering and therefore don't see a need for self help.
I don't want to get into this right now, and then I'm going to pass it over to Joe real quick, but we are going to get into a philosophy in either this show or the next by Dean Williams, which is, let's not really focus on this term stutterer. Let's focus on what interferes with normal talking. So it's a great point, Steve. And if you can hold it, we will get to it either this show or the next. Mm-hmm. Joe, did you have
write it down?
Will do. Yeah, actually,
will do. He's not kidding. Joe, did you want to have a last comment and then we're going to move on?
Well, I guess I'm just wondering because I think, you know, maybe we'd all agree here that the problem, you know, for I think a lot of people, the problem about stuttering isn't really the stuttering itself, but it's really all the pain that this stuttering creates. So it just makes me wonder, are there a lot of people out there who are really quietly suffering with stuttering? You know, are they quietly miserable, word-changing, and really unhappy? Or are there a lot of people out there, as Steve was just saying, who, you know, may be mild stutterers who don't even really care and it doesn't even bother them? Or is it somewhere in between?
Yeah, or both. Yeah.
And what does it take for people to actually come forward and say they have a problem?
Yeah. All right, next.
Big topic that we just barreled through. So if you have thoughts on this, please send them in, stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com or our voicemail, 206-888-4619. Peter wants to get through this.
Sorry.
Let's go, bro.
I was just going to mention that Joe is really good, as Steve is. Joe's really good for Stutter Talk because I'm noticing that you always try to end conversations with points of common ground, and that is really to be applauded with all sincerity. So that's great, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter.
All right. So, person who stutters versus stutterer. We have covered this in the past, but we've gotten more questions and phone calls about this. So we're going to do it quickly here. We're also going to link from episode 166 of StutterTalk.com, couple shows we've done on this topic with Ken St. Louis. Let me just say quickly that Dr. St. Louis has done research on the terms, on many terms, including person who stutters versus stutterer, and he found in his research that the public does not hold stutterer any more negatively than person who stutters. Steve, let's start with you. What is your opinion on this matter? Are you a person who stutters or a stutterer?
To me, it really doesn't matter. I usually, when I do introduce myself and want to advertise and disclose stuttering, I usually do say I'm a person who stutters. But to me, there is no real difference. And it might be because I don't view the term stutterer in a negative way.
What was interesting to me on the Facebook post was that at one point, somebody said that, he heard us using the term person who stutters exclusively, and I was like, what? But yeah, I don't have a preference either way. I don't think either one is more or less offensive than the other one. I have gotten a lot of usage, personal gain out of calling myself a stutterer, because I tried to run from stuttering my whole life. And for me to say when I'm advertising that I stutter, I'm a stutterer, there was something really strong in that. Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think I really agree with both of you guys, and I agree with Dr. Ken St. Louis as well. And I think mainly for two reasons. Reason number one is that, you know, the word stutterer actually means person who stutters. I mean, that's the definition of a stutterer, is a person who stutters. So, you know, I think in some ways it's kind of silly even to worry about an either or. But I think too, the second reason is that my wife is a runner. And if I were to call her a runner, she wouldn't say, "Hey, I'm more than just a runner. I'm a person who runs, and I'm a lot more than that." That's a ridiculous thing. And so the only way you could be upset about the word stutterer is if you felt that stuttering was really negative and really bad. And you're certainly, you know, free to do that, but I just don't view stuttering as a morally bad problem.
I think therapeutically, you go with what the client wants. If the client's a stutterer, he or she's a stutterer. If they're a person who stutters, then he or she is a person who stutters. Working with preschoolers, I love what Ehud Yairi and his colleagues have done, which is children with stuttering-like disfluencies, because they're not sure if they're going to stutter. Maybe they're going to be in the 80% who outgrow it. But right now, and I use this with parents of preschoolers all the time, right now your son, your daughter, is having moments of stuttering-like disfluency. So
right.
One thing I do reject is when journals in our field say to us we must submit articles using person-first language. And I makes me just want to be stutterer, stutterer, stutterer.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It goes back a little bit to what we've been talking about lately, like how Van Riper was such this like hard-nosed, tough-love guy. For people to get, well, for the field to get so up in arms about us using the term stutterer as opposed to person who stutters, because you're a person with many things and you're not just a stutterer, to me, that's going too far and being too sensitive, and we could use some just, listen, call a spade a spade.
I will say one thing, though. I have taught maybe about 10 graduate classes, and I made the mistake, I think, of using the word stutterer my first class. And then when I heard graduate students asking me questions about stutterers, it didn't sit right with me. And so the decision, So the decision I made after that first class was, I always say to them, you're going to hear me use the word stutterer. I would prefer if you use person who stutters, but you can use anything you want. But I would say to them, the reason I'm suggesting that to you is you don't want to accidentally offend somebody who's coming to you for help. So I suggested until somebody gives you some insight into the fact that they're comfortable with stutterer, you might want to not risk pricking them the wrong way. You might want to not do that. And if it sort of hits me, like when a graduate student is like, yeah, so, the exam on stutterers, how many questions is that going to be, Mr. Wright says? You know, I'm like, that doesn't sit right with me. So that, yeah.
Oh, well, when you say it like that,
but that's
it
how
does
it
does sound a little, you know.
Yeah.
I think person who stutters does come across a little smoother. And I think utterer, I think it does sound a little bit more, I don't know, not negative.
Abrasive, maybe?
Abrasive, yeah. But for me, and I think Peter is right, I think it is very individualized.
I just want to say I was watching the show 30 Rock, and someone on the staff must either stutter or be a person who or know a person well who stutters, because a lot of times they like throw in small stuttering kind of references. But the character played by Tina Fey, Liz Lemon, she once used the term stutterer in when she was explaining something to somebody. And I actually thought it was kind of cool. It's like, wow, like this person is speaking with the same lingo that we do. And it felt like she was also part of the club or something.
Yeah, but she's really hot too. So, I mean, so guys, let's take a break. And when we come back in, I'm going to explain to everybody What the Stuttering Orgasm.
Hey, this is Sarah D'Agostino from the National Stuttering Association, and I've got a riddle for you. What does Jimi Hendrix's guitar and over 600 people who stutter have in common? Answer? They'll both be in Cleveland in 2010. Yes, it's the National Stuttering Association's 2010 conference this year in Cleveland, Ohio. It's July 7th through the 10th, and it is the premier meeting of people who stutter of all ages, including children, teens, and adults who stutter, as well as their parents, family members, and professionals in the industry. Check it out online on our website at www.westutter.org.
Hi, this is Greta Klein, and I'm listening to Stutter Talk.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. Peter Wrights is here with Eric Jackson, Dr. Joseph.
Oh. Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
Joe, I love you, man, and respect you.
And Steve Marchant. Did I say your name correctly?
Yes, you did. You got it.
Yeah, Steve has a constant smile on his face, and it's a pleasure to record with you, Steve.
Oh, thank you. I enjoy being here.
Okay. So, Dr. Klein, we have a question from our good friend Joel Cordy that we got on Facebook, and we're going to give you a stab at it, and maybe in another show we'll all take a stab at it.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, so Joel said, and we covered this a little bit last week, Joel said, is there any way to properly test the efficacy of a stuttering device or treatment if you are saying that there is really no scientific way of measuring stuttering? How can we truly promote any type of therapy if this is the case, if there's really no scientific way to measure stuttering? Joe?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really good question that Joel has, and I think my answer to that is that we can measure stuttering. We just can't do it with just one measure. And I've feel like, you know, if you want to get a good grasp on whether a product or a therapy is really helping stuttering, I think you need to have a fluency count of some kind. I think you need to have a good understanding of the person's attitudes and feelings, whether through the Oasis or something like that. And then I think you also need to have some kind of a good qualitative rating scale that the person who stutters is using and completing to let us know whether or not it's helping them. And so I feel like if you get all three of those, and that perhaps even the most important part of that is that qualitative question, but that if you get all three of those together, I feel like you can fairly accurately measure whether something's improving someone's fluency or their stuttering or not.
We all want to jump in.
It's hard, but we agreed upon trying to get through this and saving our thoughts for another show.
Now, I think we can, to follow up Joel's common ground thing, I think we might all agree that there are certain issues that we'll bring up another time, such as variability of stuttering and avoidance behaviors that make all this very difficult. And some would even say paper and pencil tasks that we use are very tough to judge because we don't know if people are telling us what they really think.
Right.
But we're going to save that all for another time. But thank you, Joe. Great answer.
thanks, Peter.
Yeah. And we will come back.
Get the Peter seal of approval on that one, Joe.
We will come back to this topic. I'm thinking now that when we say we're measuring stuttering, what we're often saying is that we're measuring the stuttering or orgasm, the end of the event. So what my question
is... Bow-chicka-bow-wow.
So my
Peter,
question... So what
you did
I'm
it right here, didn't you?
Trying to figure out is when does the stuttering moment occur? We talk about the moment of stuttering and we assume it's that. Or this is the moment of stuttering. I'm thinking now, these are the fireworks of stuttering. This is the orgasm. So the question is, if we talk about sex, when does sex begin? Does sex begin when you're having an orgasm? Now, some men might think that way, but okay, but just give me a minute here. I promise I'm going to try to be brief. Does sex begin on a Thursday when I send my wife a text message saying I miss you? Does sex begin when you're sharing cheesecake and coffee after dinner? Does sex begin when you come home and you kiss your wife?
Does sex begin when you take your money out of the...
Yeah. Okay. I will accept that interruption to my grandstand error because that was funny. Okay, so I'm going to give one example of where I'm going with this. I was working with a child yesterday, and we were doing this thing which I love, which is I was asking him to stop when he was stuttering and to tell me what he was doing. So he got stuck on an L word, and his brother's name starts with L. And I know that L words are words he usually gets stuck on. Like every time he says any word that has an L in it, he stutters on it. So maybe he said something like, upstate, I saw a lighthouse. And I stopped him and I said, tell me what you were doing there. And he said, well, I always stutter on L words. Well, okay, I know you always stutter on L words, but tell me what you did. What was it that blocked you up there? Well, I cannot say L's. I can't pronounce an L. So I stutter on it. I always do that. Well, I know you always do that, but what did you do? Well, it feels like my throat is actually moving backwards. It feels like my throat is moving backwards. So we started exploring this, and he realized after a while that at first he said his tongue couldn't reach the roof of his mouth. And then I showed to him that, in fact, his tongue was at the roof of his mouth. The problem was he was having trouble getting his tongue off the roof of his mouth. And he had a light bulb moment. And he realized, wow, when I lower my tongue, I'm done saying the L sound. So my question is, when the child says, when I was upstate, I saw a lighthouse, we are, as a field, often assuming that the stutter was lighthouse. My question is, isn't the stutter also when his lip trembles at the beginning of the sentence? Isn't the stutter when he slows down his rate or speeds up his rate before the stutter because he's anticipating the stutter? Isn't the stutter the thoughts he has in his head that I can't say L's because I never can? Isn't the stutter also this misunderstanding of his own speech that he actually convinced himself he can't physically say an L? When in fact he had problems physically moving off the L after he said it. So are we measuring stuttering or are we measuring stuttering orgasms? I think we're measuring the orgasms. Does anybody want to take first shot at this?
for the visual here, we're all kind of looking around and it's a funny moment at Stuttered Talk when there it is in a person jumping to a microphone, but that truly was a moment where we were kind of like,
maybe the first time ever.
Yeah right.
Can I just say, I'm sorry, Eric. No, another thing is, and we have talked in recent weeks as friends and as friends who get excited about topics a little bit about this overt and covert stuttering thing. And it made me think – And I think we've all had this night, gentlemen. Maybe we've had a couple drinks and we're 20, 30 minutes into sex. And maybe we're like, you know what? Not saying this has ever happened to me. But maybe we're like, you know what? I don't think this is really happening tonight. So maybe we just go to bed, try another time. So the question is, if you don't have an orgasm, did you have sex? And if you don't hear the stuttering fireworks, did you stutter? And I think we make the mistake in our field of thinking that if you don't hear the orgasm, if you don't hear the hard stutter, we might accidentally make the assumption there was not a stutter there. Joe.
Well, I just want to say that reminds me of a great story that Walt Manning has told before, that he had a client who was in a high school English class, and it was the kind of thing where everybody finishes a quiz, and then you hand your paper to the person to your left, and that person grades your paper, and then they hand it back, and you get it. And this client of his ended up getting a 90 on the quiz. And as they're going up and down the row saying what they got, he realizes, I can't say 90, and I can't say 80. So it comes to him, and they said, all right, John, what'd you get? I got a 70. So he was okay, next person. So he never actually stuttered. There was never any stuttering there. Yeah. But that was a significant moment of stuttering that cost him 20 points on that quiz.
But wouldn't you say, though, that the thoughts were stuttering? I mean, isn't that a part of stuttering? A fear and then telling yourself that you can't do something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just like,
right.
But just like Peter said, you never actually had the climax of having the stuttering.
Mm.
You know, it never happened, but yeah. It did.
It's... I think Peter makes an inventive, colorful, smart analogy here.
Thank you, my friend.
You're welcome. And it took me a little while. We first spoke about this on the car ride up yesterday, and it was a similar moment. I was kind of sitting there after Peter was finished telling me about this, and I was like, and Peter asked me if, are you just tired, or do you think I'm crazy, or what?
I thought he was choking, maybe, because like, it was a rare moment of
silence from Eric.
And that's not a diss. We have a lot to say, people.
Right, right. Yeah, aren't you bringing up the problem with measuring overt stuttering? So, like,
yes,
it sounds like the perfect example of the problem you're describing here is if a person in therapy doing an evaluation on this stutterer would just use something like an SSI-3, and that's it.
Which, for those who don't know, is a frequency stuttering count, and they also say a severity stuttering count. So it's only measuring overt, audible moments of stuttering.
I mean, I don't really know what else to say about this. Certainly, if we continue if the thought that overt characteristics of stuttering are the one and only, or the major way to describe how much of a problem stuttering is for somebody, then there's a problem.
It's a good point. Does anyone else want to jump in before I jump in? Okay.
No, he's itching to
jump in. I actually do want to go back then to the question we asked by Joel and by Joe's response. So here's the thing. If what I just said is true, or is possibly true, then how is it that we still need to count and measure a person stuttering Monday and then where it is Tuesday?
Well, I mean, to me, because the overt aspects of stuttering are an important part of stuttering. They're certainly not the only important part of stuttering, but it's one important part of stuttering. And so to me, you have to measure overt measures. You have to measure attitudes and feelings. You have to measure just sort of overall satisfaction. How's my speech going today? So to me, it is one important part.
And does it matter where in therapy that person is, if they're just starting speech therapy, or if they've been in speech for years and years? Does it matter? Is it more important to count the stuttering frequency in the beginning?
I'm not sure if it's the beginning of therapy that counts so much. I mean, one reason I could think to measure moments of stuttering is if you are fairly convinced that your client is not avoiding. And if your client is not avoiding stuttering, and if your client says, I would like to stutter less often, or I would like to stutter in a different manner, then perhaps then I could find some use in measuring stuttering. I will also say that the research we have in our field has pretty much demonstrated that when you get a bunch of speech pathologists together to measure someone's stuttering, they disagree on how much there was. However, they might be more inclined to agree upon overall how is the person stuttering. So in probably there's a good chance, if we're talking about evidence, that subjective evidence is better than our objective measures right now.
I think it's impossible to say which is better. My gut feeling on this is that, obviously, like I said before, if we are using overt stuttering characteristics as the major indicator of the problem, then we have a problem. At the same time, though, I think it's a mistake to completely disregard that overt stuff. It's really hard to take information, to take subjective information, and to know it's valid. I'm not saying because taking overt stuttering is easier we should do that, but I don't think that we should just forget about overt stuttering, because when you hear overt stuttering, you're sure that there is stuttering going on.
You know, I just have a couple things to say about that too. I think this is all so true, and that I've certainly had clients who, you know, my sort of early on goal for them is that they'll actually have more stuttering. Is that they're working so darn hard to hide their stuttering that it's making them miserable, and that I actually want there to be a little bit of stuttering out there. And so that's one part. And then I think the second part is, I think a lot of times if people are trying to change their stuttering and improve, I think oftentimes they need to have more stuttering, at least at first, so that they know how to change what they're doing. And then I think often in therapy, it can be, you know, one step either behind or to the side before you can make two steps forward. And so you need to, that time to experiment and change those overt moments of stuttering.
I agree with you, but what concerns me, unfortunately, is that so many people who are, let's say, into measuring stuttering are not getting to what you just said, Joe. The assumption is, if you stutter 10 times on Monday and you stutter 8 times on Tuesday, that's success. And if you stutter 10 times on Monday and 12 times on Tuesday, that is not success. So I agree with you 100%, Joe. And if you're measuring stuttering, and if you're understanding that more overt stuttering may be a sign of an individual's success, then we're moving more in the right direction. I still keep my same concerns about our ability to measure a stutter. Let me give another example, if I may. I've been having a trouble in therapy recently because I keep getting wonderful clients who have gone through fluency shaping programs, and they come in and they talk like this, and then I'm left trying to figure out what's stuttering, what's fluency shaping, and they say to me, no, I'm not using my tools right now. And then we play it back and they go, I think I was using my tools there. So what some people call fluency, or as Woody Starkweather said, sometimes the cure is worse than the disease. So if we're measuring stuttering and we're getting this forward moving struggled speech, which for some people is really great because that's what they want. They want to get anything out. But if that's what we're getting, how can we even begin to put that on a stuttered, non-stuttered measurement scale? Yeah, that is a swampland of a mess. And I'm finding that in real life, this keeps happening to me. Let me give one more example. I'm sorry to hold the floor, but I think this is huge. Recently, I was working with an adult who was very self-aware of what he was doing and not doing. And I said, you know, on a scale of 0 to 10, tell me how much you think you're stuttering now. 0 being no stuttering, 10 being as much stuttering as he could imagine. And he said, 2, maybe 3. I thought he was a 7 or 8. I thought he was having much more struggle than he thought. Now, that's not because I'm a bad therapist. That's because I can't figure out what's the stuttering and what's the tool. And so if I can't, and I live and breathe stuttering, then how are we going to try to measure that in a stuttered, non-stuttered measurement? I'm going to say it's impossible. I'm going to say right now that trying to measure somebody who has ingrained these prolonged speech patterns like that in their speech, how can I say that's stuttered or not stuttered? Anyone?
And does, I mean, I think that you are describing me years ago. That is the way I was told to deal with my stuttering. And to me, I did not like that sound. I disliked it as much as I disliked stuttering. And so, was I fluent or was I not stuttering? Yeah, but it still was not. It still was not okay for me to speak that way. So I think this is a very big topic. And there are days, and I was explaining to Eric and Joe before, that some days I will be stuttering overtly more, but feeling very confident about my speech. And then other days it may be because I'm not speaking as much because I'm, you know, don't want to stutter, but I'm not stuttering as much.
I don't think the problem is that overt stuttering is a bad indicator of the problem. I think the problem is the fact that people fall back on the overt stuttering as the ultimate measure of the stuttering problem. Again, I completely agree with Joe. To me, overt stuttering is a very important piece, but it's only a piece. And to disregard it, I think would be a mistake. And what really needs to happen is there has to be a loud voice, though, that makes sure that people don't use overt stuttering as a fallback to like describing the entire problem. Do you agree with that?
I actually don't. I'm going to say I agree with you that there's a major trickle-down problem where we come up with ideas because of those of us who specialize in this, and then it trickles down to maybe the school-based therapists who simply believe that severity is based on counting stutters. However, I think the leaders in our field also weigh these frequency and severity overt audible stuttering measures way too much. And in fact,
right. But the point I'm trying to make is that it's not that that measuring overt stuttering is a bad thing to use in an assessment.
But you didn't
let me finish. Hold on a second. It's just the fact that people are not doing the right things with it.
Yeah, I'm going to stand by. I personally think it's pretty close to a waste of time. That's my thought. I think that if we have a pretty good subjective idea of how a person is one day and how they are the next and how they are over time, I don't need to spend a good portion of the client's money and time counting and measuring their stuttering. Let me just add a couple pieces. Aside from what I just said about the stuttering orgasm and when does stuttering begin and are we measuring stuttering or are we measuring the fireworks, there's some pretty big issues of variability and avoidance. And Woody Starkweather, I should have brought the exact quote with me, but in his book Fluency and Stuttering, he basically says if you're really going to take a stuttering count, you need to take a count of the avoidance behaviors and have those avoidance behaviors as part of the syllable stuttered equation. And you need to be doing some adding and subtracting. But because we can't do that, because there's no way to adequately measure those avoidance behaviors, we're never going to have a reliable count of stuttering. I agree with that. And I just think there's so last comment. There's so many, in my opinion, better ways for me to spend my time and the time and money of my clients that counting their stuttering to me is a waste of my time and their time. And I really believe that.
But what about people who don't necessarily avoid a lot and are just coming out with stuttering, not trying to hide it, right, just doing it? Like, why wouldn't a count in that sense be a valuable tool?
Well, I did concede that point maybe 10 or 15 minutes ago, but I will say in this same sort of classic book, Fluency and Stuttering by Woody Starkweather, he makes the point that to some extent all stutterers avoid stuttering. All stutterers avoid stuttering to some extent.
Yeah, I think what's so hard here too is that, you know, the original problem with the stuttering is the overt stuttering. You know, a child starts to stutter, starts to have an overt problem talking, but that, you know, depending on the child, within 3, 5, 10 years, you know, for different children, the main problem may no longer be that overt stuttering. It may be how much they're trying to avoid, or how in pain they are about their stuttering, or how they're not talking in class, or something else is really the main problem, even though it wasn't the cause of the main problem. So, you know, I think it is such an individualized issue with where that client happens to be and with what the major presenting problem is. If I have a 12-year-old who's not talking ever in his class, you know, the problem isn't the stuttering as much as the fact that they're not talking. That's the biggest problem. You know, once we can get them talking, then we can worry about, you know, how much they may or may not be stuttering.
I think on Joe's common ground, wonderful way to bring us together, that's a good place to end this episode of Stutter Talk. Thank you for listening. Peter here with Eric, Dr. Joe, and Steve. Stutter Talk at stuttertalk.com, 206-888-4619.